Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a resident, and this is the 133rd episode of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this episode, I'll be continuing my USMLE Step 1 Neurology Review. So this will be a Neuro Review 3. And my focus today is going to be on the cranial nerves, okay? This will probably extend into the next podcast because I can already see how this could go for a really longer period of time. But yes, in this episode, I'll be talking about the cranial nerves, right? I mean, anyone that has taken step one, you already know that the cranial nerves are high yield to know, right? Like, there's literally you're going to find cranial nerve questions on your exam. If you don't know about the cranial nerves, you really shouldn't be taking step one, right? Maybe not the best idea in the world. Okay, so let's jump right into it. So, I'm going to approach the cranial nerves from multiple angles. I feel like the thing that makes people freak out with cranial nerves is they just don't have the information well organized. If you have the information well organized, you notice that you actually do a lot. They're actually not that hard to remember. Really the way that I thankfully still remember the cranial nerves in great detail to this day, yes, obviously from like tutoring and all that stuff, but also just having good organization from the get-go, I think that helps tremendously on exams. So before I even jump into the first cranial nerve, I'm going to talk about some groupings that I just really feel would help tremendously on a test. And then one other thing I also plan to do is, in the future, I plan to make, because I know that also for just med students, just starting out med school, when you're doing gross anatomy, cranial nerves are a bear to learn, right? So I plan to, for sure, in fact, in the very near future, make like an actual cranial nerve podcast, but that's targeted more for people in med school, not necessarily people taking step one. So I'll go into like more extreme detail compared with what I'm going to go into detail on now. For this, because I initially thought of making one podcast that will satisfy the needs of a med student in a gross anatomy course, and also like a med student taking step one. But the overlap, yes, there's overlap, but there's a lot of stuff that I feel like will be agonizing for a step one person to learn. So I'm just going to separate both. So I'll make like a dedicated cranial nerve podcast just for medical students. Hopefully I should have that out within the next few days. So let's go ahead and begin. So the first thing you want to keep in mind with regards to the cranial nerves are that you want to first be able to make sure that you are able to integrate them with clinical syndromes. That is what a lot of your friends at the MBME test on exams. That's the first thing. The second thing is, in fact, I guess this is where I'll formally start, right? Is you want to be able to group your cranial nerves into cranial nerves being motor or cranial nerves being sensory, right? Because the thing is, there are some cranial nerves that are purely motor, right? There are some cranial nerves that are purely sensory. And then there are some cranial nerves that are mixed, right? So they have both motor and sensory functions. And the thing is, the mixed cranial nerves, it's actually kind of easy to remember which is which because they are the most complicated nerves, right? I mean, like if you remember back from like your first year learning gross anatomy, you probably agonize. Just really think about it. What were the cranial nerves that had the most branches, the most pathways, the most pain or headache from learning, right? That's like 5, 7, 9, and 10, right? So 5, 7, 9, and 10, right? So like your trigeminal nerve, that's cranial 5. Your facial nerve, that's cranial 7, right? Your glossopharyngeal nerve, cranial 9. And then your vagus nerve, cranial 10. Those are the most agonizing to learn, right? So it will make sense that those should be mixed cranial nerves. They're agonizing because they just have too many things going on. And then there are some cranial nerves that are purely motor, okay? Cranial nerves, they are purely motor. And really the way to remember them is just remember like 3, 4, and 6, and then 11 and 12, right? So like oculomotor, trochlear, abducens, spinal accessory and hypoglossal, right? And the thing is, it's actually very high yield on, like, there are some foundations I want to lay in this podcast, right? It's actually very high yield to know that the purely motor cranial nerves are found medially in the brainstem. It's very important to remember that there is an embryologic reasoning behind that, but I'll discuss that in a different podcast. Again, I don't want to cause a brain overload here, but the motor cranial nerves, remember M for motor, M for medial, they are found medially in the brainstem. There is like some weird stuff with like basal plate, inner plate and all that. That's kind of like the embryologic undertone, but I'll talk about that later. And then there are three purely sensory cranial nerves. And the way to remember them is just remember the number 128. Okay, the one is for the olfactory nerve, right? The two is for the optic nerve, and then the eight is for the vestibulocochlear nerve. Basically, the nerves that the cranial nerves that carry like special sensation, right? They are for the most part purely sensory, right? And if the purely motor nerves, cranial nerves were medial in the brainstem, it should make sense that the purely sensory cranial nerves should be lateral in the brainstem. And then the mixed cranial nerves, which are essentially like the, again, like your 5, 7, 9, and 10, those should lie somewhere, they should be like mediolateral. They should be between the purely medial or the motor cranial nerves 3, 4, 6, and 12, 3, 4, 6, 11, and 12, and the purely sensory cranial nerves, which are 1, 2, and 8. Okay, so again, very high yield to remember these. And then also one thing that would also help with understanding the cranial nerves as we proceed is remembering that the cranial nerves, right, they do carry some autonomic nervous system fibers, right? So just kind of like a quick summary with the autonomic nervous system, I would hope that you remember that your ANS controls like most of your visceral body functions, right? And we already know that we have like the somatic nervous system, right? Remember, that's like a one neuron system where you essentially go from the anterior horn, right, like the ventral horn of the spinal cord to skeletal muscle. But the ANS, right, is a two-neuron system, right? The two neurons is like you have one neuron and then you have a second neuron, and those two neurons are separated by a ganglion, okay? And remember, right, your somatic nervous system, like the anterior horn, I would hope that you remember, like, your anterior horn diseases, right? So, like, spinal muscular atrophy, right, where people have, like, mutation, chromosome 5, autosomal recessive inheritance with the survival motor neuron 1 gene, right? So they will describe a kid that's, like, less than a year old with, like, fasciculations, losing motor milestones, a sort of deal, right? And then hopefully you also remember that polio, right, and West Nile virus torch the anterior horn of the spinal cord. So that's your somatic nervous system. But again, your autonomic nervous system, it's a two neuron system. The first neuron is the preganglionic neuron. The second neuron is the postganglionic neuron. And again, I said those two neurons are always separated by a ganglion, right? So it should kind of make sense that one is preganglionic, so prior to the ganglion, and then another should be postganglionic, so distal to the ganglion. The ganglion is kind of like the middleman. It's like the go-between between the pre and the postganglionic neurons. And the thing is, right, your parasympathetic nervous system, right, the preganglionic neuron, right, so the first neuron is long, right? Because if you kind of think about it, the middleman for the parasympathetic system, the ganglia, is located in the walls of organs, right? And these cranial nerves, parasympathetic nerves, for example, right, like the preganglionic, they all kind of start in like, at least for the vagus nerve, that's more like in the brainstem, but they all kind of start like in the spinal cord, right? So if you want to travel from the spinal cord all the way to the wall of an organ to meet your ganglion, to meet your middleman, right? That means you have to travel a pretty long distance for that to happen, right? So the thing is, in the parasympathetic nervous system, the first neuron, the preganglionic neuron, is long, again, because it has lots of ground to cover before it gets to the associated ganglion, right? And then the postganglionic neuron is short because it just needs to go from the wall of the organ to somewhere inside the organ. Okay, that is really all I want you to remember. If you remember that, then just take the opposite and you already know that what the sympathetic nervous system should be. The sympathetic nervous system has like a short preganglionic neuron, right, and a long postganglionic neuron, right? Because remember, for your sympathetic nervous system, the ganglia lie very close to the spinal cord, right? So in fact, those ganglia are called like paravertebral. So paravertebral means juxtaposed to vertebral bodies, right? So paravertebral ganglia, right? So the preganglionic neurons don't need to travel that far to get to the middleman, to get to their go-between, which are the paravertebral ganglia. Now, so how does your autonomic nervous system relate to the cranial nerves, right? So the thing is, some of your cranial nerves, they carry autonomic nervous system fibers, right? So, and for the most part, these are usually parasympathetic fibers that they carry, okay? So again, the big cranial nerves that carry autonomic nervous system fibers, again, especially parasympathetic, are cranial nerves 3, 7, 9, and 10, okay? So 3, 7, 9, and 10. 3, 7, 9, and 10. So like your oculomotor nerve, like your facial nerve, your glossopharyngeal, and your vagus. And just for purposes of, again, people taking step one listening to this podcast, this is not related at all, but maybe this is a way you can remember two things at once. If you substitute that three, so I just said 3, 7, 9, and 10. If you substituted the number 3 for the number 2, you're left with 2, 7, 9, and 10. Those are actually the, and then I guess if you add protein, CNS, those are the things that are gamma carboxylated by vitamin K epoxide reductase, okay? Those are the clotting factors that are gamma carboxylated by a vitamin K epoxide reductase. But that's like warfarin business and all that stuff. But I just thought, I guess I'll go ahead and throw that in there. So your autonomic nervous system, again, like I said, mostly parasympathetic fibers that relate to the cranial nerves. There is some weird sympathetic stuff, but I think I should maybe talk about that later so that I don't confuse you. And the thing is, the cranial nerves, right, that carry parasympathetic, like parasympathetic, like ganglia, right? You want to kind of know the associated ganglia for those parasympathetic functions, right? So, for example, like cranial nerve 3, you want to remember that it it has like the ciliary ganglion, right? For cranial nerve 7, I want you to think about the pterygopalatine and the submandibular ganglia, okay? And then for cranial nerve 9, I want you to remember the otic ganglia, okay? So cranial 3 is ciliary, cranial 7 has two like parasympathetic associated ganglia, right? So like pterygopalatine, submandibular, and then cranial 9 is the otic ganglion, right? And then remember, cranial 10 is kind of special in its own right. Vagus nerve goes to many visceral organs. For the most part, those ganglia, like the associated ganglia, are in the walls of organs. And then one of the high yield thing you want to know with your cranial nerves, right? You want to know where their nuclei are located, right? And really the easy way to remember this is to just go ahead and start from the medulla in series of fours and just count upwards, right? So it's like your medulla, right? The cranial nerves like 9 through 12, so like 9, 10, 11, 12. So glossopharyngeal, vagus, spinal accessory, and hypoglossal, their cell, like their nuclei, right? They're all in the medulla, right? And then cranials 5 through 8, right? So counting up the next four, so like cranial 5, trigeminal, cranial 6, abducens, cranial 7, facial, and cranial 8, vestibulocochlear. Those have their cell bodies in the pons. And then cranials 3 and 4, they have their cell bodies in the midbrain, right? They have their cell bodies in the midbrain. And remember that cranial 1, right? Cranial 1 and 2, they are not much in the way of brainstem associated cranial nerves, if you want to put it that way. And I'll say some special like embryologic stuff about cranial 2 shortly. And one thing I want to say about those pontine cranial nerves, right? So cranials 5 through 8. The thing is, cranial 5, it's like the main pontine cranial nerve. The truth is, cranial 6 through 8, like 6, 7, and 8, those actually are found more like at the cortico-medullary junction, right? So sometimes you may see people that have like medulla-associated syndromes having like some pontine cranial nerve deficits. The reasoning behind that is that the medulla, like the junction between the medulla and the pons, actually is where cranial 6 through 8 for the most part stand, right? And I'll say some more neuroanatomical stuff about those as we go along. And then there are some laws. This is more for people that are taking a gross anatomy course, but I think this will also help some on step one for like the oddball question or two where you do need to keep some things at the back of your mind. The thing is, there are some laws known as Stern's, so S-T-E-R-N, Stern's laws. They help you remember certain muscles that are innervated by certain cranial nerves, right? So the thing is, these Stern's laws are kind of like the solubility principles you may have learned in undergrad. When you were learning like, you probably learned like 6 or 7 solubility rules that, if the cation in a salt is a group 1 element, so like sodium or potassium or whatever, then that salt is always soluble or whatever, right? And then, oh, there's rule two, but you should only apply rule two if you've already applied rule one, or if rule one doesn't count. That's kind of like the same thing with these Stern's laws. There's three of them. The Stern's laws basically state that, so rule one, right, is that if any muscle is, if you have a tensor in the name of any muscle, that means it must be innervated by the third branch of the trigeminal nerve. That's like cranial V3. That's the mandibular nerve, okay? And then rule two is that if you have any muscle that has the like word palate in its name, then it's already, that means it's innervated by the vagus nerve, okay? So like any muscle that has palate in its name is innervated by the vagus nerve, but that's only if rule one. But rule one essentially precedes rule two. And then rule three, and I'll give you an example of this. Rule three, if any muscle has glossus in its name, that means it's innervated by the hypoglossal nerve, right? Cranial nerve 12. And it's only superseded by rules one and two, right? So I'll give you a classic example. Like palatoglossus, right? Palatoglossus is, so you see glossus in the name. It's actually not innervated by cranial 12. It's actually innervated by cranial 10. Okay, the vagus nerve, right? And the reason, again, palatoglossus, right? It's around the palate, glossus, right? Is rule two precedes rule three, right? So palatoglossus, believe it or not, is actually innervated by the vagus nerve. And then some big things, I guess, you want to also keep in mind with the cranial nerves are to know like your holes, right? You want to know certain things that traverse certain holes, right? So unfortunately, this is just flashcard material. This is just very unfortunately something you would have to commit to memory, right? So like your greater petrosal nerve, right? You want to know that it goes through what foramen? Foramen lacerum, okay? Your mandibular nerve, what does it go through? Your foramen ovale, right? Okay. How about your olfactory nerve? Right, that'll be your cribriform plate in the ethmoid bone, right? So your cribriform plate, ethmoid bone is traversed by cranial one. Remember, if you have like a cribriform plate fracture, that can cause anosmia, right? And then your internal carotid artery, what does it go through? Goes through your carotid canal, right? That's kind of easy to remember. How about your hypoglossal nerve? Again, this one is also easy, hypoglossal canal, right? And then how about your middle meningeal artery? What does it go through? It goes through foramen spinosum, right? Remember that your middle meningeal artery, right? It kind of runs through the temporal bone as well. Whenever you fracture a temporal bone, you scrub the middle meningeal artery. That can cause an epidural hematoma. Okay. Now, how about like your cranials 7 and 8? So your facial and your vestibular cochlear nerves. What do they go through? Well, that's the internal acoustic meatus, right? And then how about like cranials 3, 4, V1, and 6? So like your oculomotor nerve, your trochlear nerve, your ophthalmic nerve, right? That's the first branch of the trigeminal. And then the abducens nerve. What do they traverse? I hope you're saying the superior orbital fissure, okay? That one is especially high yield to know for exams. And then what is the hole? So basically, if you take all I just mentioned in the previous sentence and then add cranial V2, right? So like the maxillary nerve. What holes do all those things traverse? I hope you're telling me the cavernous sinus, right? It is floridly high yield to know what goes through the cavernous sinus. And it's floridly high yield to know what goes in the wall versus what goes in the middle, right? So like cranials 3, right? So your oculomotor nerve, cranial 4, your trochlear nerve, cranial V1, your ophthalmic nerve, cranial V2, your maxillary nerve, and cranial 6, your abducens nerve, those all traverse the cavernous sinus. And then cranials 9 through, so remember that V2, the maxillary nerve, does not go through the superior orbital fissure, okay? But the maxillary nerve goes through the cavernous sinus, okay? It's only V1. V1, the ophthalmic nerve, is the only branch of the trigeminal that goes through the superior orbital fissure. Okay, now, how about like cranials 9 through 11? So like your glossopharyngeal, your vagus, and your spinal accessory. Hole do they go through? Well, I hope you're telling me the jugular foramen, right? Remember, your sigmoid sinus also goes through even your inferior petrosal sinus. The inferior petrosal sinus is kind of high yield from the standpoint of inferior petrosal sinus sampling. I'll talk about that in an endocrine review down the line, but yes, those all traverse your jugular foramen. And then your maxillary nerve, right? I said your maxillary nerve goes through the cavernous sinus, but remember, it also goes through foramen rotundum, Okay, so remember cranials, V1, V2, V3, right? So V1, your ophthalmic nerve, goes through the superorbital fissure. V2, the maxillary nerve goes through foramen rotundum. And then V3, the mandibular nerve goes through foramen ovale. And then your optic nerve, so cranial 2, the ophthalmic artery, which is one of the branches of the internal carotid, what hole does he go through? Right, it goes through the optic canal, right? And then this one is also especially high yield, the facial nerve. Remember that before the facial nerve exits the face, remember it goes through something called the stylomastoid foramen. Okay, the stylomastoid foramen. This is actually very, very high yield to know for exams, right? So let's kind of talk about that. So if you notice, you may see, Divine, I thought this was a cranial nerves podcast. Yeah, I promise you it's a cranial nerve podcast. But the thing is, again, I try to teach things in a way that I'm useful for exams. Okay, so again, I think it'll be much more useful to learn these groupings before I then delve into the cranial nerves themselves. And when I delve into the cranial nerves, they'll be much simpler to remember and understand if you have this foundation I'm focusing on right now. So the cavernous sinus, right? In fact, you may be surprised that if you learn these early parts, like, you may already know a lot about the cranial nerves before you even jump into learning them, right? So the cavernous sinus, right? Again, like I said, it's kind of important to know what goes through the cavernous sinus, because it's actually clinically relevant, believe it or not, right? There's many pathologies of the cavernous sinus thrombosis, and all that stuff. There's a lot of like high yield things that go through the cavernous sinus, right? So, like I said earlier, right, cranials 3, 4, V1, and V2. And again, repetition always helps. If you remember, I've said this factoid now like 3 or 4 times, right? So, 3, 4, V1, V2, right? So, like, again, your oculomotor nerve, your trochlear nerve, your ophthalmic nerve and your maxillary nerve, okay, they all pass along the lateral wall of the cavernous sinus, okay? They all pass along the lateral wall of the cavernous sinus. And then cranial 6, right? So like your abducens nerve, the internal carotid artery, they all pass in the middle of the cavernous sinus, okay? And again, remember, all the cranial nerves I've mentioned here, with the exception, right, of like V2, the maxillary nerve, they also all pass through the superior orbital fissure, okay? Again, very, very high yield to know that. And then let me also say some high yield things, I guess, about the brainstem, right? Because unfortunately, your friends, the MBME, right? They love to give questions relating to the brainstem. And again, like I said, I'll try really hard to finish this cranial nerve podcast within the next like 2 days or thereabouts, right? Because I think it's just something that I want to just. So one problem I want to solve, because again, I've gotten a lot of like requests from people to make a cranial nerve associated podcast, right? So what are some, I guess, high yield things you want to remember with regards to the brainstem, right? So this part, you really do want to pay a lot of attention, right? So remember the brainstem, right? Like, there is the part of the brainstem that, in fact, let me make this super, super easy for you. The part of the brainstem that faces the face, okay, I mean to make that rhyme there, but the part of the brainstem that faces the face, okay, is the ventral side, okay. The part of the brainstem that faces the cerebellum, okay, is the dorsal side, okay. So, brainstem part that faces the face, right? So, like, the more anterior part is the ventral side. The more posterior part that, again, faces the cerebellum, or like your occiput, is the dorsal side of the brainstem. So, ventral, anterior, faces the face. Dorsal, posterior, faces the cerebellum, okay? Now, what are some, I guess, good high yield things to know about the ventral surface of the brainstem, right? So, let's sort of take it from the top, right? The thing is, and I will go from top to bottom, right? From top to bottom. So the thing is, the ventral surface of your brainstem is actually where most of your cranial nerves arise, okay? Most of your cranial nerves, they arise from the ventral surface of the brainstem, right? And remember, right, we've kind of talked about some high yield things here already, right? So we've talked about like how the olfactory nerve, right, cranial nerve 1, right, it kind of goes through the cribriform plate of the ethmoid bone on its way to exiting the cranial cavity, right? And then we've kind of talked about like the optic nerve, right? Remember the optic, remember it's kind of called like cranial 2, it's called optic nerve prior to the optic chiasm, right? But after the optic chiasm is called the optic tract, okay? So prior to the chiasm is called the optic nerve, distal to the chiasm is called the optic tract, okay? And remember that the optic nerve is actually a derivative of the diencephalon, right? So one, I guess, key piece of embryologic trivia that many people don't seem to focus on for the USMLE step 1 is that all your cranial nerves actually derive from the peripheral nervous system, believe it or not. All your cranial nerves, this is super high yield to know, they are all derived from neural crest with one exception, okay? So neural crest gives rise to all your cranial nerves with the exception of cranial nerve 2. Cranial nerve 2 is a derivative of the diencephalon, right? So if you remember that, you already know right off the bat that if a person has like a demyelinating disorder of the peripheral nervous system, like Guillain-Barré syndrome, it should ideally not affect cranial nerve 2, because cranial nerve 2 does not come from neural crest, okay? So Guillain-Barré syndrome typically does not cause visual symptoms. It can, but typically on NBMEs, it does not cause visual symptoms, right? And all your other like cranial nerves, right? Like your cranial 3, blah, 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 right? It should make sense that they should be myelinated by Schwann cells. That's why, again, because you may wonder, how do people get schwannomas, right? And you're like, oh, at the cerebellopontine angle. Well, guess what, right? Schwann cells actually exist like within the brain, because again, certain parts of like your head and neck, right, again, are derived from your peripheral nervous system. But contrast this with like a disorder, like a demyelinating problem of like your CNS, right? Like neural tube, like multiple sclerosis. If you notice, people that have multiple sclerosis, they tend to get a lot of like eye symptoms, right? Like intranuclear ophthalmoplegia, or I guess the more paramount one that maybe relates to the idea I'm trying to get across here is optic neuritis, right? Because remember in MS, right, those people have problems with oligodendrocytes, okay? Because oligodendrocytes myelinate derivatives of your central, not peripheral, central nervous system, okay? So if a person has MS, right, for the most part, the cranial nerve that tends to get all bungled up is cranial 2, okay? The optic nerve, because again, the optic nerve is a derivative of neural tube, not neural crest. It's a derivative of the diencephalon. Okay, now, if you then, I guess, jump to the midbrain, right? So in the midbrain, right, on the ventral surface, right, we have the cerebral peduncles, okay? The cerebral peduncles. Please do not confuse the cerebral peduncles with the cerebellar peduncles. The cerebral peduncles, you actually find them anterior, so the cerebral peduncles, you find them ventrally in the brainstem, so the anterior in the brainstem, like in the midbrain. The cerebellar peduncles, you actually find them dorsally. You find them posterior in the brainstem, okay? So again, I'm just talking about anterior brainstem right now, right? So we have the cerebral peduncles. Remember, the cerebral peduncles, they essentially have like, those are, because remember, your descending pathways, like your corticospinal tract, sort of starts in the cerebral cortex and goes all the way down, right? The thing is, as it goes all the way down, right, it, it goes through the brainstem before it decussates at the medullary pyramids, right? The thing is, as it's going through the brainstem, as it's cutting through the midbrain, the place it cuts through is the cerebral peduncles, okay? Now, why is it important to know about the cerebral peduncles? It's important to know about them because there is like a space between the cerebral peduncles. There's like one cerebral peduncle on the left, there's one cerebral peduncle on the right. Between those peduncles, you have something called an interpeduncular fossa, okay? The high yield thing to know about the interpeduncular fossa is that the cranial nerve 3, right? So your oculomotor nerve actually traverses that interpeduncular fossa on its way to the superior orbital fissure and cavernous sinus kind of business. And then, if you then go to the pons, right, you have the pons used, like if you remember from Gross Anatomy, the pons is like this huge bulge, right? So again, I'm talking about the ventral surface right now. You have this huge bulge of the pons. That's all you need to know about the pons. That huge bulge are just fibers of the corticospinal tract. And then if you go to the medulla, right, the medulla, right, anteriorly, again, you just have like your medullary pyramids. Okay, your medullary pyramids, right? Remember, that's where you have the corticospinal tract decussating or crossing over to the other side, right? And again, like I said, if you're going through the anterior, the ventral brainstem, again, like in the midbrain, you'll find cranials 3 and 4, okay? Cranials 3 and 4. And then in the pons, right, again, you'll find cranials like 6, 7, 8, and... No, sorry, you'll find cranials 5, 6, 7, and 8, Okay, and again, like I said, if you look at the anterior, like the anterior pons, right, you notice that right in the middle, dead smack in the middle, you have the two abducens nerves, right? And again, it's in the middle because it's a purely modal cranial nerve. Remember, 3, 4, 6, and 12 are your purely modal cranial nerves. And then, if you sort of look off to the side, if you notice the thing that is the cranial nerve that is most lateral in the pons, right, is your purely sensory cranial nerves, like cranial 8. Okay, cranial 8 is purely sensory, right? So you'll find it, so your vestibular cochlear nerve, you'll find it most lateral in the pons, okay? But but 6 and 7, sorry. Yes, but 6, so 6 is in the middle, 8 is very lateral, and then in between those you have 7, because 7 is a mixed nerve. It's a modal and sensory, right? And then remember again, like I said, 6 through 8, you find them mostly at the pontina medullary junction, right? Versus 5, that is more like rostral. It's like a little like more, it's like the mainstream pontine cranial nerve 5, because it's so complex, right? And then again, when you get to cranial, when you get to the medulla, right, you have like cranial 12, that's the most medial. Okay, again, and again, all these things you may say, Divine, why are you harping on medial, lateral, blah, 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 blah. I will use this knowledge to teach you a trick for resolving essentially any brainstem lesion on the USMLE Step 1 exam. It's kind of like a high yield trick to know, but it kind of depends on your understanding and remembering some of these rules. Although, to be honest, I'll also teach you another rule that may even obviate the need for you to remember some of these rules. But again, having that understanding is what will help you and carry you all the way there on step one, right? So cranial 12 hypoglossal nerve is purely modal, so it's the most medial in the medulla, right? Again, ventral or anterior medulla, the side facing the face, right? And then after that, we kind of have like cranial 11, spinal accessory nerve, cranial 10, cranial 9. Again, those are all off to the side, okay? Because again, those are not purely modal, like the hypoglossal nerve, which is cranial nerve 12. And then if you're looking at the, at the dorsal brainstem, right? So you're kind of looking in the back. So again, like the side that's facing the cerebellum, right? If you're sort of walking your way down from midbrain down to the medulla, right? The thing is in the midbrain, right? We have like in the back, the big, big structures you'll notice are, you'll notice that we have like four bulges at the back of the midbrain, right? Those are called colliculi, right? So we have like the superior colliculi and the inferior colliculi. Right. The thing is, it's very high yield to remember that the superior colliculi, they control like a vertical conjugate gaze, right? So they control vertical or conjugate gaze, right? So if a person has a problem at the level of the superior colliculi, they can have like a vertical diplopia. So they have like double vision in the like in the long axis, right? So like when they're looking up or down, they have a diplopia. So you may ask, okay, Divine, what can cause problems with the superior colliculus? Well, here's what. People can have problems at the superior colliculus if they have a pineloma, right? A pineloma, right, is like a pyrenoid syndrome, right? Because remember, the pineal glands actually lie superior to the superior colliculus. Again, I'll repeat that again. The pineal gland is superior to the superior colliculus. So if a person has a pineloma, right, that pineloma can compress the superior colliculi and that patient will have a vertical diplopia. Believe it or not, that is something floridly high yield that they test all the time on the USMLE Step 1. And then if we go, so below the superior colliculi, we have the inferior colliculi. Your inferior colliculi, they deal more with like hearing, right? So like auditory sensation. But it's actually kind of high yield to also remember something. If you go inferior to the inferior colliculi, that's where you have the trochlear nerve, right? So remember I said earlier on that essentially all the all the cranial nerves exit from the ventral, brainstem, okay? So like the anterior brainstem. The thing is, the trochlear nerve is an exception to that rule. The trochlear nerve, cranial nerve 4, exits in the dorsal brainstem, okay? It exits, very high yield to know this, in the dorsal brainstem, okay? So it exits in the dorsal brainstem, right? So it's the only cranial nerve that does that. And the thing is, The trochlear nerve is also the only cranial nerve that gives crossed findings, okay? So if a person has problems with the left trochlear nerve, they'll have problems in the right eye, okay? And the reasoning behind that, again, is because it essentially crosses in the back and then makes its way to the front, to the associated eye. Right. So again, superior to the superior colliculus, you have your pineal gland, so pineoma, pineal syndrome sort of business. Inferior to the inferior colliculus, you have your trochlear nerve, okay, cranial nerve 4. And again, it's the only cranial nerve that exits dorsally in the brainstem, and it's the only cranial nerve that gives crossed findings. Most cranial nerve deficits are ipsilateral, to the side where you have the deficit, but the trochlear nerve is different. If you have a trochlear nerve lesion, you cause problems contralateral to the deficit. And then also remember in the midbrain, right, just in front of just a little ventral to the superior colliculi, you have the pretectal nucleus, right? The pretectal nucleus sort of controls your pupillary light reflex. I'll talk about those reflexes in a later podcast. But basically, right, your pupillary light reflex, the afferent part of that reflex is cranial 2, your optic nerve. So your optic nerve brings in information, and then from the pretectal nucleus, it projects bilaterally to the bilateral cranial 3s, right? And then people get all and then you have the efferent part of your pupillary light reflex. I'll talk about that later, but there are certain problems like Argyro-Robertson pupil and stuff like that that are lesions at the level of the pretectal nucleus. And then if we go downwards to the pons, right? The pons, the big things you want to remember here, the pons are where you have the cerebellar peduncle. So again, like I said, do not confuse the cerebral peduncles with the cerebellar peduncles, okay? Your cerebral peduncles are located in the midbrain and they are ventral in the brainstem. Your cerebellar peduncles are located dorsally or posteriorly in the brainstem and they are found in the pons, okay? And then if you go below that, right, you have your medulla, right? And your medulla, in the medulla, there are some key dorsal structures you have, right? So think about a tract coming from your spinal cord, your dorsal columns, right? It should make sense that if your dorsal, remember, you probably know this already, that the dorsal columns, those fibers synapse in the dorsal, the synapse somewhere in the medulla, right? But it should make sense if they are called dorsal columns, it should make sense that they synapse in the dorsal medulla, right? Again, I know neuro has a bad rep amongst the med students, but neuro is actually a lot of fun, and it's actually very logical if you just think about it for a second. So your dorsal columns, right? You probably remember your nucleus corneatus that is more lateral in the brainstem, and your nucleus gracilis, which is more medial in the brainstem. Your nucleus, your cuneate nucleus and your gracile nucleus, they are both found in the dorsal brainstem. Okay. And then the olives, you also find them in your dorsal brainstem. So that's something you want to keep. Actually, I take that back. Your olives are found in the ventral brainstem. Sorry about that. So again, your dorsal columns, right, your cuneate nucleus, your gracile nucleus, they found in the dorsal brainstem. In fact, the medial lemniscus, where those fibers cross, right, ultimately decussate, you also find that in the dorsal brainstem. And then your spinal thalamic tract, right, that carries pain temperature and pain prick from your spinal cord, right, from your periphery, right, those also run in the dorsal brainstem. But again, if you think about it, your spinal thalamic tract, it's a sensory pathway, right? So again, it should make sense that it should run in the lateral brainstem, not the medial brainstem, just as per the rules I discussed earlier, right? And then also your sympathetic nervous system, right? So there's this concept that for some reason people seem to get wrong on exams. So let's maybe talk about it real quick. And again, I'm going to bring this podcast to an end fairly soon, right? Because again, this is going long. But again, even if I've not expressly talked about one cranial nerve, I've already said a lot about the different cranial nerves. And again, all these little extra stuff, extra understanding stuff, that is where the MBME focuses a lot of its efforts when it's writing questions. But many people think, right, so if people hear the autonomic nervous system, they're like, oh, my sympathetic nervous system, thoracolumbar, my parasympathetic system, cranial sacral, those things all start in the spinal cord. That is actually not true. Your autonomic nervous system, believe it or not, actually starts in the hypothalamus. Okay, so the thing is, again, I know I've taught you that the autonomic nervous system is a two neuron system, and that is actually what you should learn for exams. But your autonomic nervous system, if you really delve deep, is more like a three neuron system, because there is an original fiber that sort of starts, like kickstarts things in the hypothalamus, and then runs down through the dorsal brainstem in the lateral part of the dorsal brainstem, comes all the way down and goes to the spinal cord, and then innervates those like thoracic and lumbar fibers that are, for example, the thoracolumbar fibers that constitute your sympathetic nervous system. I'll say more about this in the next podcast, but it's like, oh, you have a fiber going from like the hypothalamus to the thoracic and lumbar spinal cord, right? So that's like almost like the neuron that no one ever talks about. And then those, say for example, if you're dealing with the face and we're talking about sympathetic nervous system, the preganglionic fibers then start like in the thoracolumbar cord. They go to the superior cervical ganglion, right? And then from the, I guess if you're doing more sympathetic face, you're doing more like thoracic or spinal cord. So they go to the superior cervical ganglion. The ganglion is then the middleman. And then from that ganglion, you have the postganglionic fibers that then go to different parts of the head and neck. Again, I'll talk about those things as we go to the next podcast. But I do think, yeah, I've said enough here. But again, I promise you folks, this first one especially is like super, super high yields to know. I know I'm at the 40 minute mark, but I don't know, like there are some things that are kind of still like gnawing at my my mind that I want to talk about. Should I leave this to another podcast? Let's see. Okay, you know what? Let me just say some quick things here, and then I'll throw in the other stuff in my other podcast, right? So the midbrain, right? I already talked about how the superior colliculus, inferior colliculus, and the midbrain. I remember that the substantia nigra, right? You actually also find it in the midbrain. Okay, remember, if you have depigmentation of the substantia nigra, right, that can cause a Parkinson's, right? And also remember, you can destroy the substantia nigra if you take like improperly cooked like opioids like MPTP, right? That can cause like a Parkinsonian syndrome, right? So that's something high yield you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And again, cranial 3 and 4, you find them in the midbrain, like the Edinger-Westphal nucleus. I'll talk about that in the next neuro series, right? And all that stuff. You all find those are in the midbrain. And I think this has gone on for too long. Let me pause here. We'll continue this in a later podcast. So as I always do when I end a podcast, right? So I do offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE exams, step one, step two CK, step two CS, step three. And then I also tutor for like the preclinical med school exams, the third year shelf exams, like the clerkships. And then if you're an internal medicine resident, if you need tutoring for the internal medicine like board exam, the ABIM exam, and also the in-training exams, I do offer tutoring for those. And then if you have like a college buddy that needs tutoring for like physics, gen chem, o-chem, biochem, physiology, histology, I do offer tutoring for all those things, right? And then if you're a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCASAP, or a med student applying to residency, right? I know this is kind of like application season for a lot of third years, right? So like an ERASAP, I do offer one-on-one advising/consulting for that. So like personal statement writing, application prep, mock interviews. Again, I have a ton of experience. I've worked with a ton of people in that process. And essentially everyone I've worked with has matched. Most of them between their first to third choices, like probably like 70-80% matched at their first choice. So take that for what you will. So reach out to me anytime. Reach out to me either through the website or you send me an email like divineinterventionpodcasts@gmail.com. So have a wonderful rest of your day. God bless you. I'll see you in the next podcast. Thank you.